Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
There and a very warm welcome to today's broadcast. I'm Veronica Scaresbrick and I'll be with you for the next half hour. Coming up in a few moments. From Palestrina to Tavna, glorious notes for Mary's Assumption into Heaven. And not Canterbury, but Glastonbury, once the foremost pilgrim shrine in England. Thanks very much for joining me once again. As I mentioned a moment ago, I'd like to begin today by celebrating the Assumption of Mary into Heaven. I choose to do this on a musical note with our music historian, Monsignor Philip Whitmore. Join him as he provides us with a musical comment on the fourth glorious mystery of the Rosary.
Assumpta est Maria. Mary has been assumed into heaven. The angels rejoice. They sing for joy and praise the Lord. This is what we celebrate in the fourth glorious mystery of the Rosary. Christian art loves to depict the scene with Mary borne aloft by angels, while the disciples gasp with astonishment from earth below. And any text about rising to heaven is a gift for a composer. Listen to the joyful, surging scales in Giovanni Pierluigi da Palestrina's motet, Assumpta est Maria. Palestrina's music has always been held up as a model of the most perfect form of Renaissance polyphony. He became something of a legendary figure in the 19th century among those who wanted to revive the sacred choral style of the 16th century. It's easy to see why. The classical purity of this intricate interweaving of voices seems to evoke the perfection of a bygone age, and at the same time, the glory of the world to come. For those of us living in Rome, the name Palestrina has a local ring because it's the name of a small town a short distance away, a good place to go for a day out of the city. Pope Julius III had been the Bishop of Palestrina before he was elected to the papacy, and when he moved to Rome, he brought with him his former cathedral organist, Giovanni Pierluigi. Unlike many Roman composers of the time, Palestrina was not a cleric. He was married with a family. In fact, an exception was made for him to sing in the Cappella Sistina, normally open only to celibates. He did consider entering the priesthood after his first wife died, but it was not to be, and in due course he married for a second time. The doctrine of Our Lady's Assumption has a long history, even though it was only in 1950 that it was solemnly defined as a dogma of faith by Pope Pius XII. It has a particularly venerable tradition in the Eastern churches. St. John Damascene, for example, wrote beautifully about the mystery. In the East, it's normally referred to as the Dormition of Our Lady. Let's listen now to a musical meditation on this theme for the unusual combination of string quartet and handbells, written by the living English composer John Taverner, himself a member of the Orthodox Church. It's called The Last Sleep of the Virgin. That air of mysticism, evoked through the simplest of means, is characteristic of John Taverner. His music is deeply religious, and it often achieves its effect through constant repetition, almost like a musical mantra. That makes it seem particularly appropriate for a meditation on the rosary. I'd like to finish with one of Taverner's most important works to date. The Protecting Veil, written in 1988, is a piece for solo cello and string orchestra based on a vision of Our Lady sheltering the beleaguered Christians beneath her all-encompassing veil. In the composer's own words, the Mother of God is represented by the cello and never stops singing throughout. The accompanying string music is a gigantic extension of her unending song. We've been listening to a passage from the sixth movement, entitled The Dormition of the Mother of God. And let's allow ourselves, as we listen, to be transported into contemplation of that great and glorious mystery.
Heartfelt thanks there to Monsignor Philip Whitmore for so generously sharing with us his expertise in the field of sacred music, and indeed his precious time. Monsignor Whitmore is a music historian currently working at the Vatican's Secretariat of State. Meanwhile, moving on in the broadcast, it's time to join Jill Bevilacqua as she speaks to us of a stunning place of pilgrimage deep in the countryside of England's southwest. A place more famous in this day and age for reasons other than spiritual. Ever heard of the Glastonbury Abbey musical extravaganza? I'm sure you have, but anyway, I won't give too much away right now, offering my colleague the chance to tell the story herself, as it's one she's particularly familiar with. Be sure to stay tuned.
A place which is linked today frequently with the adherents of the New Age was once the foremost pilgrim shrine in England. Not Canterbury, not Westminster, but Glastonbury in Somerset, in the southwest. An event which has been described as the broadest pop concert in Europe takes place during one weekend every year, transforming a group of fields into a town of some 100,000 young people, and a sea of mud reminiscent of Passchendaele. But the Glastonbury Festival, which began in the 1970s, doesn't happen in Glastonbury at all, but a few miles away at Pilton. Every June, however, Catholics and Anglicans go on pilgrimage to the other place, to what is held to be the earliest site of the Christian faith in England. Mingling with tourists, they stand to pray among the ruins of Glastonbury's great Benedictine Abbey. England's first Christian foundation, writes the guidebook, survived Saxon, Danish, and Norman conquests and presents a continuity of religious life unparalleled elsewhere. But Glastonbury did not become an abbey until the 8th century. Its previous history is a patchwork of chroniclers' records telling of the presence of Celtic saints, St. Patrick, St. Bridget, and St. David of Wales. In the 6th century, we're told, Welsh missionaries staffed a Christian hermitage, and the community, as the Welsh chroniclers record, had a perpetual choir, Laus Perennis, where the Holy Office was chanted in relays by 100 men every hour. But the true fame of Glastonbury rests on a legend, first written down in the 12th century, and which made of this island in the marshes a holy land in miniature. For Glastonbury was indeed once an island in the midst of flat marshes, which, we may read, were connected by tidal channels to the open sea, and which stretched for miles, thick with willow, alder, and hazel, and alive with wildfowl of many kinds. The highest point of the island was Glastonbury Tor. Tor is an old English word for an abrupt or lofty hill. It's 500 feet and more. The legend recounts that the Christian faith was brought to England in 63 AD, or even earlier, by none other than Joseph of Arimathea. John Adair writes in The Pilgrim's Way.
According to the story, the Apostle Philip, who had just converted Gaul, sent him with a band of missionaries to carry the good news into the islands of Britain. Joseph brought with him the Holy Grail, the cup used at the Last Supper, which Pontius Pilate had given to him, and in which he had caught Christ's blood during the crucifixion. After many adventures, Joseph and his companions made a landfall somewhere in the southwest of England, and made their way towards Glastonbury Tor. Exhausted by their journey, they rested on a hill about a mile southwest of Glastonbury, a place thereafter known as Weary All Hill. Reaching the Tor, St. Joseph made ready to pray. His hawthorn staff, which he thrust into the soft ground, immediately sprouted with delicate white flowers.
Joseph's staff took root and grew into the legendary Glastonbury thorn, which flowered every Christmas in honour of Christ's birth. Hawthorn is normally thought of as a spring flower, and its other name, May, refers to the time of year it usually appears. H.E. Bates describes hawthorn blossom as the risen cream of all the milkiness of Maytime. But in the Gardener's Encyclopedia of the Royal Horticultural Society, you will find this entry under Cretagus, hawthorn, biflora, and in brackets, Glastonbury thorn, has flowers and leaves in mild winters as well as in spring. While Richard Mabey, in his Flora Britannica, writes,
the most celebrated old hawthorn is the Holy Thorn at Glastonbury in Somerset, which produces flowers and young foliage in midwinter, as well as blossoming again at the normal time in May. The tree is first mentioned in an anonymous early 16th century poem entitled Here Beginneth the Life of Joseph of Arimathea.
The poem described three thorn trees growing on Weary All Hill, just south of Glastonbury, which do burge and bear green leaves at Christmas, as fresh as other in May, when ye nightingale rests out her notes musical as pure glass. Maybe also came across a variety of explanations linking the thorn with Joseph of Arimathea, two of which he quotes.
A variant of the story suggested that the tree sprang miraculously from a fragment of Christ's crown of thorns brought to Britain by Joseph. Another, that the second blossoming coincides with Easter, so that the two flowerings symbolically encompass the whole of Christ's earthly existence.
There seems no end to the inventiveness which this thorn has produced. Certainly the legend was believed for centuries, and men came to pluck a sprig of the holy thorn that it might be buried with them. Cuttings were also taken, and, as Mabey comments...
In one way, this was fortunate, as the Glastonbury tree received a more drastic and eventually fatal hacking from the Puritans, who abhorred idolatry, especially of trees. But a cutting was soon established in its place, as were similar cuttings all over England.
But when the calendar was revised in 1752, we read, "The trees were the subject of widespread superstitious attention, to see if they would bloom according to the old or the new calendar." What happened, we may read in this extract from The Gentleman's Magazine, 1753.
Quainton in Buckinghamshire, December 24th, 1752. Above 2,000 people came here this night, with lanthorns and candles, to view a black thorn which grows in the neighbourhood and which was remembered, this year only, to be a slip from the famous Glastonbury thorn. That it always budded on the 24th, was full-blown the next day, and went all off at night. But the people, finding no appearance of a bud, was agreed by all that the 25th of December could not be the right Christmas day, and accordingly refused to go to church, and treating their friends on that day as usual. At length the affair became so serious that the ministers of the neighbouring villages, in order to appease the people, thought it prudent to give notice that the old Christmas day should be kept holy as before. Glastonbury. A vast concourse of people attended the noted thorns on Christmas Eve, new style. But to their great disappointment, there was no appearance of its blowing, which made them watch it narrowly the 9th of January, the Christmas day, old style, when it blowed as usual.
And in conclusion, Mabey tells us,
"These days the blossoming of the trees is extremely variable, sometimes after a mild autumn, as early as November, sometimes not until early March, if there's a severe winter. But each year, just before Christmas, a spray from one of the thorn trees, which grows in St. John's Churchyard in Glastonbury, is sent to the Queen, who is said to place it on her breakfast table on Christmas morning."
But to return to the story.
St. Joseph decided to settle on the firm land near the foot of the Tor, called in Celtic the Isle of Glass, and lived there as leader of a small community of hermits. Guided by the angel Gabriel, the companions built the Vetusta Ecclesia, the ancient church, the first Christian church in Britain. Christ himself is said to have appeared in order to dedicate it. In another version of the legend, the young carpenter of Nazareth came to England and made this church of boughs with his own hands from wattle and daub on a timber frame in honour of his mother, the Virgin Mary.
And as John Adair comments,
"Thus, by the exercise of creative imagination, the unfamiliar is made familiar. The seeming chasm between first century Palestine and medieval England is wonderfully spanned."
And the wonder and awe of the medieval pilgrim is captured, he writes, in the words of what we know as a hymn, but which was written by William Blake in the preface to his poem, Milton.
"And did those feet in ancient time walk upon England's mountains green? And was the holy Lamb of God on England's pleasant pastures seen? And did the countenance divine shine forth upon our clouded hills? And was Jerusalem builded here among those dark satanic mills?"
What about the Holy Grail? which Joseph had brought with him. Grail comes from the old French word graal, which in its turn comes from the Latin gradalis, bowl. Well, it seems that Joseph decided to bury the grail in a secret spot somewhere near Glastonbury Tor. And this gave rise to another legend, that of the quest for the grail by King Arthur's Knights of the Round Table. Many believe that Glastonbury is the Isle of Avalon, a Celtic name traditionally interpreted as Island of Apples, and in Celtic mythology as the Island of Blessed Souls. Arthur was said to have been spirited away to Avalon after his last battle, and here he's said to lie buried together with his queen, Guinevere. And on the grass at Glastonbury is a sign which reads, "Site of the ancient graveyard, where in 1191 the monks dug to find the tombs of Arthur and Guinevere." Legends apart, though, what of England's first Christian church? Joseph's building of plaited osiers would soon have fallen into ruin. So new, bigger and more solid churches rose on the ancient site, and the pilgrims continued to come. Then, in 940, St Dunstan became abbot. He introduced the Benedictine rule, and under him the abbey became a centre of learning and gave England many great churchmen. Dunstan had been born near Glastonbury, so perhaps it's not surprising that it was in his time that this place reached the peak of its glory. Until 1154, moreover, the mitred abbot of Glastonbury was the premier abbot of England. Not every abbot, however, is all he should be, nor was Glastonbury any exception, if we're to believe what this extract from the Anglo-Saxon Chronicles reports. Abbot Thurston was one of the first Norman abbots after the conquest, hence the reference to the Frenchmen.
1083. There arose discord in Glastonbury between the abbot Thurston and his monks. It came first through the abbot's lack of wisdom, in that he misdirected his monks in many things. The monks complained of it amiably to him, and asked that he govern them aright and show them love, and they would be faithful to him and obedient. The abbot would not have it so, but did them evil and promised them worse. One day the abbot went into chapter and spoke to the monks, and meant to mistreat them. He sent after laymen. They came into chapter upon the monks, fully armed. Then the monks were very frightened of them, and knew not what to do. They scattered. Some ran into the church and locked the doors on them. They went after them into the minster and meant to drag them out, since they dared not come out. But a pitiful thing happened that day. The Frenchmen broke into the choir and pelted the altar where the monks were. Some of the men went on to the upper floor and shot downward with arrows towards the sanctuary, so that in the rood that stood above the altar stuck many arrows. The wretched monks lay about the altar. Some crept under and desperately called to God, praying for his mercy, when they might not gain any mercy from men. What can we say, but that they shot fiercely? The others broke the door down and went in, struck some of the monks dead, and wounded many therein, so that blood came from the altar onto the steps, and from the steps onto the floor. There were 3 struck dead there, and 18 wounded.
A sad episode in the history of this holy place. But alas, worse was to come. The first monastic foundation in England, Glastonbury was the last to go. In 1539 it was suppressed by Henry VIII, its community dispersed, and its abbot, the 80-year-old Richard Whiting, executed on Glastonbury Tor, together with 2 of his monks. After the Reformation, the buildings were neglected, and until about 1830 served as a stone quarry, where every Tom, Dick and Harry could help himself at will. In 1908, the ruins were bought for the Church of England. And what has Glastonbury to offer to the pilgrim of today? As you come in from the marketplace and pass through the Abbot's Gate, you can stop and visit the museum. But the pilgrim is immediately drawn to the visible reality. The ruins, as the Michelin guide writes, extending far across the lawns, stand tall amid majestic trees. And traveller H.V. Morton notes,
"Rising sheer from the grass is the great arch of the central tower, and 2 piers rising into the air, but not to meet. There is blue sky between, and on the high cleft towers grass is growing."
Roofless ruins, then. But 5 feet under the turf are the Saxon walls, and still standing today are the walls of the Lady Chapel, which was built, we're told, on the exact site of the old wooden chapel, and so it said, in strict fidelity to the ancient plan. A prosaic note is struck by the fact that the only building to survive intact is the abbot's kitchen, a huge square construction, 70 feet by 40, with an eight-sided stone roof, out of which rises a lantern, which served to draw the smoke from the corner fires in the kitchen up the flues in the roof. There are four fireplaces. And Arthur Mee comments,
"The stone lantern, 12 feet across, weighs many tons, yet it seems to hang lightly in space, and a builder who examined it failed to find a single crack that could be thought a sign of weakness."
Inside the kitchen is a display showing how the monks lived, and on my first visit we were treated to a demonstration of how they made their bread. It's time to go, and as we reluctantly retrace our steps, the words of a sign placed amid the ruins return to mind. A Christian sanctuary so ancient that only legend can record its origins. And whatever we may think of the old story, writes one, Glastonbury is holy ground where saints have trod. Concludes John Adair in The Pilgrim's Way.
Neither the Reformation nor the secular centuries which followed it have quite dispelled the mysteries that cling to this former island in the marshes.
Well, I hope you enjoyed this programme written and presented by Gilbert Villacqua. My thanks too to Sean Patrick Lovett, whose voice you've just heard. And be sure to visit Glastonbury in Somerset, England. It's well worthwhile. And that brings us up to time. I do hope you enjoyed this broadcast. Thanks for listening. I'm Veronica Scaresbury.
You've been listening to the English programme of Vatican Radio. Laudato Jesus Christus.